Hello there, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 144. This is Greg sitting in for Johnny again, who I'm afraid couldn't join us this week, but joining me as usual, site director John Lindemann.
A pleasure as always, Greg.
Thank you, John. Thank you. And features editor, James.
Thanks for pointing that one out. The illustrious features editor position.
To remind everyone of your responsibilities, including yourself.
By the way, I'm looking forward to E3 when I introduce myself as a features editor, and they're just going to ask for me to get the previews editor on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do you have someone who matters on your staff that's here?
Yeah, we're all looking forward to E3.
Hey, I'm the gatekeeper to our awards that are going to come out in March, you bastard.
You're a vital cog, James. A vital cog.
Yeah. Joining us, I'm glad to say joining us again, I think it was a couple of months ago, is Neil Ronahan.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, and Neil does a lot of hard work for us on the site recently.
Unlike
and
everyone else.
More assets than you can shake a stick at, I guess.
It's true. And one of the reasons why we've got Neil on this week is because he's also been covering an EA event for us recently and getting us some hands-on impressions from...
All two different games that were playable there.
Yeah, there was some other like eyes on stuff, was there?
Yeah,
apart from Grand Slam Tennis and Tiger Woods.
So we're gonna describe eyes on stuff in audio form when the videos are already online.
Yeah,
technology.
I would definitely recommend Neil and Lucas, one of our new staff writers, have impressions of the Tiger Woods and Grand Slam Tennis on the site. So at NintendoWorldReport.com, so go there and read them. But we'll get right into it with Neil. You played both.
Yep, I did.
So which would you like to discuss first?
I'll go with the better of the two, at least in my opinion, which would be Grand Slam Tennis, just because tennis is more fun than golf, just as a whole in a video game. And, I mean, without Wii Motion Plus or with Wii Motion Plus, it's just a lot of fun. It's like, takes a lot of what Wii Sports presents and just makes it better. And has over-the-top cartoony graphics. It looks good. It seems like it has this realistic cartoony look. And as far as playing with Motion Plus, it's just very, very tactile is the word that comes to mind.
Sure. So, I mean, and I read in Lucas's article on this that, in fact, sort of there was only one Motion Plus sort of unit playable at the time. You were swapping between each other, so that meant that when you were playing each other, one had it and one didn't.
Yeah.
And so, would you sort of say, like, how you could kind of quantify the difference between having it and not?
I mean, as far as, like, from a competitive angle, I mean, it's more of, I think, personal preference is what it comes down to, just with... You know, if you just have the Wii remote, then you can do the thing where, you know, you don't really have to move that much. You don't have to be that into it, like Wii Sports Tennis, where you can just, you know, sit there and...
Boil it down to little flicks.
Yeah, but with Motion Plus added, then you need to basically go, like, you need to, like, almost get up in the stance of how you would actually, you know, do a forehand or a backhand.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they both, I don't really think there's much of a competitive edge. It's whatever you prefer. But both of them work really well in Motion Plus. It was just really cool seeing just every little thing, like... I have a slight like left hook whenever I, you know, swing everything. I'm a lefty, so that's what happens.
Right, yeah.
But that registered in the game. And just really cool to see stuff like that.
But I guess a big question that some people have had with Motion Plus in terms of, as you say, how directly it translates just about everything is like, you said, with this kind of personal preference thing, do you think it could be too direct for a lot of cases? Or like, once the novelty's kind of worn off, are you like, yeah, I don't know whether I want to be doing it in a stance?
Well,
like,
I think that's kind of what I noticed more with Tiger Woods, is that there seems to be this nice, this big pro and con to Wii Motion Plus in that, you know, it's one-to-one, but it's also one-to-one, where like, with Tiger Woods, I didn't really have that good of a time just because of how precise it was. Like, you really have to be kind of decent or good at golf. There's a big learning curve in Tiger Woods.
Yeah, I think it could be a bad thing, hypothetically, but of course it's not mandatory, so I guess that's the
best. Yeah, that's the thing, is that it's not mandatory.
Yeah.
I think it's great for people that want to take it to that level. I mean, you see with a lot of different sports games, people take them to kind of lurid extremes in various ways. You know, whether it's like the kind of like personnel management side with like an NFL game or a soccer game, or, you know, or whether it's like playing online and all that. I mean, people get really into it. and, you know, to give them this kind of different way of getting really into it, which is actually kind of perfecting the physical skill part, I think that's great for those people. But as long as you've got the other way of enjoying it for other people and that's well executed, I don't see a problem with it. I mean,
don't see a point, and maybe this is me who plays games that are known to cause aneurysms, that the game can be too realistic. This game is too like the thing we're trying to emulate, unless it's like an accounting game.
There's definitely an argument for a game can be too complicated or too difficult for most people, but I guess the point is, you know, when you're explicitly kind of a simulation of a game, yeah, you know, you wouldn't think that for most people it'd be somehow unacceptable that it's quite close. But I still think it's very wise that, you know, they're not like you're making it completely exclusively Wii Motion Plus controlled and all that. Yeah.
But now, can you adjust it on a slider though? Like,
yeah, they were talking about the developer for Tiger Woods was talking about how they had it on the highest sensitivity there.
Yeah.
Because it shows off, you know, the movement in the game. So I assume there's some kind of slider in it that would probably make it easier to use, but also still have the one-to-one, just not as precise.
Yeah, so you think, yeah, in terms of, because, I mean, I know even them, I think there have been comments from Inside EA, you know, that have said, like, well, you know, maybe one of the issues with it is almost too good, and I guess they probably do have to write in some sort of code so that you can have this kind of auto-correct kind of thing maybe going on, and as you kind of slide the sensitivity, that's what's happening. It's actually like smoothing out little kinks in your motion or whatever, you know. So I think as long as, you know, it's a tricky thing to balance, but as long as what Neil's saying, it kind of accommodates different people's different preferences, I think it sounds like it.
Yeah, but if it has that flexibility, then I think it's definitely going to be great. And I think even from one end, if you're into golf and you want to get better, you know, Tiger Woods with on the highest sensitivity would probably help you a lot, because it'll help you straighten your swing and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, with Tiger Woods as well, you've got that ability to go to those real nuances with draw and fade and, you know, sort of play really advanced stuff.
Now, kind of in that vein, have they said anything about, like, sort of like a trainer, like having a way to, you know, figure out, like, for somebody who actually does golf for real, like a way to adjust their stance or anything like that, or how they hold a club? That'd be kind of cool.
I haven't really heard. Yeah, that would be really cool, but I don't think they have anything for that.
Yeah, like an in-game coach.
I'm not 100% sure on that. Then maybe they'll announce something sooner, training. But I don't know.
Bank on it.
I tell you, that's totally doable.
I think there's a possibility for it. Like, if you throw in the balance board and everything, you could have a good golf trainer.
Stop. Yeah. Someone's making money over Nintendo right now. Stop talking.
Should be me, damn it. My ideas are brilliant.
So anyway, I also saw Madden at this event.
Yeah, so Madden, this has had like a visual overhaul.
I mean, you could definitely tell it when you first looked at it, and this was, I didn't get to play it at all, I just got to, you know, developers showed it off, but you can't really tell the style right away. You kind of have, it's not really that drastically different.
Sure.
But as you look at it, it's different enough where, like, the players are just a little more cartoony, where it's still, you know, it's still realistic in the gameplay and everything, but just the overall style of the game is a lot more, like, cartoony and fun.
This denotes the first time that they've probably sort of really somewhat redone the visuals for a Nintendo console.
Yeah.
Madden since 2001.
You know? Yep. Anything beyond iterative? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, because I think basically it's been taken off the PS2 version.
Yeah.
I mean, at least the Wii one has been off the PS2 version just with added waggle. Of course, they've added more to it, too, with AllPlay last year, but for the most part, that's the basic gameplay that they're taking.
Yeah, with all the, yeah, I mean, you had all the different control stuff, the gestural, and they had the pointer stuff with the kind of audibles and all that. But yeah, basically, graphically, it's been the same since all the way back.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's been good, but I mean, you can't really screw up Madden that much. If you're into it, you're probably going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that, I mean, obviously, I guess we haven't got any kind of sense of this yet because it's too early, but the one thing I'm kind of hoping with the next Madden is they do get something of a better balance, because some of the things I heard about last year's was just like the offense was just insane, you know, like...
Greg's hoping they give better balance, but only to Buffalo.
No, that wouldn't be balanced.
There was a screen that I posted that had Buffalo on it, and...
There's nobody in the stands who's not Canadian.
It's actually in Toronto. That's where the game is.
There's just nobody in the stands. Yeah,
you can make out the Toronto skyline.
But you know, I mean, I just, to me, if you you could get 8 yards a carry or what, you know.
Yeah, no, it is ridiculous, but it's also they have 5 minute quarters and you can't really get real stats if you have.
When Tio's taking the snaps behind the quarterback, he will get 8 yards a carry.
Jesus.
Every time.
We have to keep bringing T.O. into this.
Is that a space needle on the side of their helmets?
James shows his complete ignorance of Toronto with that statement.
Yeah, it's the CN Tower. The space needle's in Seattle. Good God. Anyway, so...
Let's move on.
So you came away impressed with Motion Plus, you'd say, in general, because this is how it will be introduced to everyone now, if they actually buy these games.
Well, actually, Virtua Tennis.
Oh, yeah, that's even... that reminds me, the calibration thing. Now, we heard something with Virtua Tennis that it was going to be, like, very frequent, whereas my understanding is, like, with Grand Slam Tennis...
Grand Slam Tennis, it's all behind the scenes.
Right,
They'll have, like, if you're, you know, when we had to remove it and, you know, switch it from remote to remote, there was a little time where it would be calibrating, but then after that, it does it all, like, during load times, whenever it can.
Right, yeah.
Which, I mean, we didn't notice any faults in it.
Because that was definitely a bit of a concern that I had, kind of what I was hearing about Virtua Tennis, the idea that, you know, if it's in a tennis game, for instance, you'd play a point and then calibrate or something, you know, it'd be that frequent, it would be a little...
I don't know that much about Virtua Tennis, but from what I've seen by Grand Slam Tennis, that definitely looks like it's going to be the better game.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we've certainly heard plenty of positive things about it.
The decision to do calibration during load times, I understand it. It is definitely not something that I think we've ever seen in a game before.
But you know, I guess this is just what this gyroscopic part of the controller is dependent on. You know, I guess there's no real getting around it, and you know that may be a challenge in quite a few different settings. You know, the elegance with which you can conceal it, and you know, with all these different things we're gonna have in Wii Sports Resort, it'll be quite interesting to see like how they get around it in each case.
Yeah.
So Neil, anything else beyond your coverage from EA that you'd like to talk about?
Well, the only other two games that I saw the new Harry Potter game for Wii, which I guess looks cool. Not really my bag necessarily, but the game does look. I mean, it looks like it takes the. Well, it was developed lead for the Wii, so that's cool.
Makes sense.
And then Boombox Bash Party, which I don't really know what I can and cannot say, because even though the game's coming out in like 3 weeks.
Yes, there's NDAs all over.
They're being dodgy about info. I don't really get it.
Yeah, nobody wants to blow what happens to the monkey at the end. You know?
He gets blown the fuck up.
Yeah.
Don't do you ruin it. That's it. We're Black Ball by EA.
See, I wasn't there. I can say everything. So if I happened to hear it from Neil...
You see, the whole thing is that can only lead me to believe that the box art that they've released is actually some sort of decoy. That isn't a real box art, because it's actually...
No, John, you're giving EA way too much credit.
The new box art will spoil the end of the game, which is where Steven Spielberg comes in and can't say anymore.
Jeez.
Indiana Jones shows up with Jaws.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's actually Spielberg, Jaws, Indiana Jones, and that monkey from the first game on the box.
it's a party game.
There you go. That's actually the party.
Right. So, and in your personal gaming time, Neil, what have you been able to get?
Well, I've been playing a lot of Excitebots, but Nick talked about that last game and he put up his review the other day, which is very good, and I definitely agree with everything he said. But other than that, I got Peggle DS off of Amazon this week, which it's Peggle. It's really, really good because it's Peggle, and Peggle is very, very addicting. But I haven't played Peggle Knights yet, so I still need to power through the first Peggle.
Yeah, this is actually from Q Games, isn't it? The people that do Meteo, so you'd expect them to do a pretty good job with it, and it's been pretty roundly praised. So, yeah, I guess the price is a bit of a thing. You know, it's not the cheapest way to experience Peggle, but there is quite a lot of content.
Well, because I got the first Peggle like a month or two ago for about $2.50, I think.
Right,
and then I saw the $20 game, and my girlfriend's been really into Peggle, and she also got my old DS once I got a DSi, so then I got Peggle DS last week when it was $20 on Amazon, which I think it still is, which just seems like a good price for it, because it's Peggle and Peggle Knights, which are like two fully featured games, and then bonus stuff from Q Games.
Yeah, yeah.
The controls, I'd rather play it with a mouse, but the touchscreen controls really aren't bad, and you can do it touchscreen or just using the D-pad, which takes entirely too long. Just because you don't really have that precision.
Yeah, and anything final before we move on to John?
I've been playing DSiWare stuff, because as I mentioned...
Yeah, that's not something, obviously, because none of us on the usual cast actually have a DSi, apart from John, but John doesn't seem to have demonstrated any interest in it.
I'll talk about that.
I've been kind of a loyal DSiWare purchaser. I've gotten something, I think, every week since launch. I got WarioWare in Art Style Acquia when it came out. I put reviews of both of those up.
Yeah.
So in the effort of time, I'll just say go read the reviews. WarioWare Snap, not really that great. Acquia, pretty cool. And then the next week, I got Mixed Messages, which is really only cool if you have a lot of friends, which I guess it's mediocrely cool for me because I have a mediocre amount of friends. But you can play with up to 21 people, and it's basically the game of telephone. And I know a lot of people complain about how you can just do that with a pen and paper, but I mean, it's a pretty nice package. It saves everything that you've done. It's only $5, which is a lot of the reason why I've been biting on a lot of these DSiWare games, because they're usually really cheap. And then I got Dr. Mario the week after that, which is Dr. Mario on my DSi whenever I need it.
Yeah, it's very strict. It's very stripped down. Like, it doesn't have multiplayer, but
there's really nothing extra about it. It's just Dr. Mario. But for me, that's enough, and I've been playing the hell out of that.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Well, it's very accessible in that. Yeah. Form, yeah.
And then this week I got Paper Airplane Chase, which.
This is one of the WarioWare.
Yeah, it's one of
games.
The WarioWare things from the first one on the GBA. But I've seen, like, at least in reviews, I don't really see a lot of people that are, like, that into it, but it's $2, and it's a fun little game. Yeah, you could probably get something for $1 or free on the iPod store, but it's pretty fun for what it is, and they have an endless mode, which I've been killing a lot of time on, and they have stages and multiplayer, which is kind of weird because it has the thing where, like, one person uses left and right on the D-pad, and the other person uses Y and A on the buttons. But it's fun, and once again, the prices for the DSiWare stuff aren't that much, so my expectations aren't that high. I haven't really been let down in anything that I've gotten.
No, well, I get that. That is the main point, is to have stuff that's convenient, really. I guess. Like, if you're really into using your DS on the go, you know, that portability factor, just to have a bunch of stuff that you can, you know, put on at will without having to, like, carry around a bunch of cards or whatever is definitely the main appeal of it. All right, well, John, we'll move on to you, and I guess appropriately we'll discuss your DSi shenanigans or whatever you've got to say about
it. Well, not so much about the DSi in particular, but it kind of ties into a lot of things. You know, Neil was talking about how he got his game for $20. Well, I also got one of the really good sales at Best Buy this week was Grand Theft Auto Chinatown Wars for $20, which was pretty much a no-brainer purchase for me. You know, it was a game that I was already kind of thinking of getting, but I mean, for $20.
Yeah, so this was getting around to it with a nice little push of a very reasonable
absolutely
price, yeah.
And also it's, you know, it's also a great excuse really to kind of, you know, just sort of check out the DSi and just kind of see, you know, everything it does. Wi-Fi wise and everything, because Chinatown Wars, I mean, because I edited Nick's review, he did the review of it probably a couple weeks back, and you know, there were some parts in his review where he was just kind of like, yeah, you know, everything that's in the console game is in there. And I'm like, well, you know, I would kind of go back and forth with him on the review during the edit, and I was like, well, you know, what exactly does that mean? Like, are the cars different? You know, do they, you know, what exactly do you mean by that? And now after I've played the game, I realize that, I mean, pretty much from a concept standpoint, everything that's in the console games is in the DS one. I mean, like, in terms of just like the little things, like if you hit a light pole, it'll fall over.
Yes.
And if you hit a mailbox, it'll get knocked over. And when you're on the street, you hear people say these, like, random funny things. And there's not, like, three of them. There's, like, tons of them. And so all those little kind of touches that are in the console games really have been put onto the DS.
You can go through radio channels and get distinct, what's the word for it, tone to each station. There's no audio, there's no spoken word with them, but there is, you know, distinct music on each station.
Yeah, and it's well done, too. I mean, it's not just throwaway, you know, cheap, meaty music.
Yeah, the music is, I mean, the music isn't as great because it doesn't have, like, vocals in it, and it's not as memorable, and they don't have, like, the DJ guy, but it's still pretty good for what it is.
Yeah, there's obviously limitations with a DS card.
And especially with what else they did with that game, it's, I mean, who cares if the music is just instrumental? the rest of that game looks so great and has a lot of content.
Also, what I thought was interesting is that the map of the city, it is very, very, very close to the map in GTA 4.
Yeah.
Which you'd think, since it's a DS game, it would be smaller, but no, it's pretty much the same city.
Yeah, they kind of made a big point of this, that it was pretty much there, apart from one of the boroughs or whatever was taken out.
Yeah,
so.
I think
they took out the Jersey borough.
Yeah, I think Alderney is the only one that's missing, I think, that's what Nick said.
It's not quite as easy on the DS game because of the dimensions, but if you go into GTA 4 now, you'll see, oh wow, that entire Chinatown that they set the game in is there. And it's basically identical to what it is in Chinatown Wars.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, when you say, like, when I heard it, you know, described as, oh, it's top down, that, you know, that immediately brings to mind the old GTA games, which look terrible.
Yeah,
I mean, they're
kind of
incredibly, you know, dated and everything. But it's not like that at all. It's like, it's more like in the console games, when the camera pans out and you're driving down the street and you can adjust the camera kind of like at a top angle, that's what it looks like. It looks like you're just kind of waiting for the camera to, like, drop down behind your guy, really. Like, there's a lot of times where I'm just like, you know, I wish it could do that, but it seems like it's not. I mean, it's not like it's straight top down looking at your car. It's kind of at, like, a sort of an angle.
Oh, I guess. But it is polygonal, so you can have that kind of, you know, the sense of physicality, even though, obviously, like, it's a bit limited with what you can actually display because it is the DS. I'm sure they're pushing it pretty hard with that. Well, you kind of talked before about the possibility of some sort of fatigue with GTA in terms of, like, you had Lost and Damned just come out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, then you're talking about how this has all the stuff of GTA 4. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of GTA 4 in this game. So is it different enough that, or just by being on a handheld, that it kind of still draws you in, or how does that work out?
It's a little bit more lighthearted, I think.
Yeah, it is. There's more humor.
There's a lot more comedy in it.
And I thought about that. I thought about that exact point because I was thinking, you know, because, I mean, as soon as I started to play it, you know, it's like, it's kind of an interesting, I mean, it deals with the triad gangs, which really haven't really even been touched in most of the other GTAs. It's either been, you know, the Italian, you know, mafia, or, you know, Jamaicans or something like those other kind of ethnic groups, but the triads really haven't been touched. So that makes it interesting. And like you guys said, this really, really witty script writing in it. It's really good.
It does kind of mirror the story of GTA 4 where the guy's brought in by his family and he's sort of just thrown to the wolves in this culture he doesn't really understand. But he's surrounded by characters that he's much more willing to ridicule to their face.
Yeah.
And he's much more willing to get in there and drive them nuts as he does things.
Well, right out of the gate, they kind of set him up as, like, a spoiled rich kid who really doesn't, like, I mean, right off the bat, he's like, yeah, you know, I'm only doing this because, well, I forget what he says, because he has to take the sword back to his uncle, and he's like, he's like, I'm only doing it because I can get paid or something like that. He's like, I really don't care about all that family stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the cast of characters is better too.
Yeah,
I think they're more memorable.
Every character except for him is weird, without an exception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of them, his uncle talks like he's in a samurai movie.
Yeah.
Like the one guy ripped some dude's heart out of his body.
Well, he'll talk about things like this is all about the family's honor, and the best way to restore honor is through peace, and by peace I mean killing this guy.
Yeah. And it's like his uncle, like one of the early missions that you have to complete. It's like, yeah, you know, you have to go someplace, and you have to, you know, he's like, yeah, I'm filming like basically a porno over in this area. You have to go over and pick somebody up or something like that. And so right off the bat, it's very funny and lighthearted, which is a nice change of pace. And I found that
it kind of fits the comic book style of the cutscenes and all that, you know.
Yeah, a little bit more. And I also found it's very fast paced. Like none of the missions really take too long to complete.
Well, it's a portable game, and that's...
Yeah, it's precisely. I mean, Neil puts up a big point.
It does, however, take a whole long time to lose the police.
Yeah, it does.
It can take a very, very long time to lose the police.
Mm-hmm. Although I do like the new system for, like, shaking off the police by getting them to crash into stuff.
Yeah, but that's easier said than
still,
done sometimes.
It still takes forever.
Sometimes it's easier just to lob grenades at their cars.
Yeah,
which,
like...
you think would make them more angry at you, but in fact, it's the opposite. So if I lob a Molotov cocktail at the police, police car. Oh, my wanted level went down. Not, oh shit, the ATF is coming.
Yeah, but overall, it's very good. And I mean, it has, you know, it's jam packed with, you know, Wi-Fi stuff. I know Johnny wants to hook up and do some multiplayer.
Oh, sure, Johnny does, but not the other people here.
Have you posted your? Have you posted your friend code?
I have not.
Well, there you go.
Neither have I.
There you go, guys. There you go. That's
sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody talk shit.
Anything else you want to bring up, John, before we move on?
Yeah. The only other thing is, I started my new job this week, and that is going pretty well so far.
Yay!
So yeah, it's congrats. Nice to have a paycheck. So that's why I'm buying games again. So there you go.
Still very, very judiciously spending the money, though.
Very frugal. Yes. 35? No. 20? Okay.
All right, well, I'll move on and first of all get the formalities out of the way. This is week 2 of Excite Strike. So, that's the grumbling out of the way. But actually, in terms of what I've been playing, I've actually been playing a bit of Little King Story, which has actually come out in Europe first, turning that on its head a bit. And in fact, it actually came out on April 24th, the same day as New Play Control Pikmin 2, funnily enough.
Oh, that was terrible. Who did that?
Goodness knows. obviously, one of the big differences for Pikmin 2, other than being a new game, is that it actually has like very traditional controls. It is a Pikmin-style game, but it's all done with the buttons and the analog stick. There's no pointer in it whatsoever. And it's set in this kind of fairy tale kind of kingdom. You start off as this little kid that's become king, but you're basically being told what to do by this guy who sort of strings you along for a while, sort of just showing you the basics of, like, you know, how you sort of recruit villagers to your cause, who are sort of, you know, a sort of substitute for the Pikmin, in the sort of Pikmin analogy, but they are actually bigger than you, which is unlike the Pikmin. And then
like
once
the
you've got,
well, you're a little king.
Yeah, exactly. You're a little guy.
It's your story.
So what you can kind of learn the very basic stuff of, you know, you go out and you find like little things to sort of break up and collect for treasure, basically, and then treasure gives you money, and then you use money to build stuff. Generally, in the early part of the game, you build like basically like little factories that churn out different kinds of villagers. Like, what do you throw a villager in there and they become a farmer, a carpenter. Yeah, you know, and then they can do different stuff. They can either build stuff, or they can dig things out of the ground, or you can make them into soldiers that are better at fighting stuff.
So you're saying that you build forced labor camps?
Yeah, well, you know, they kind of go in, they come out, and they dress differently, and all of a sudden they can do stuff. It's very, very efficient training.
So it's like a Soviet-era indoctrination.
It's a subtext. Right. It's a subtext.
We don't know. We have no idea what goes on in those few seconds there inside.
It's probably for the best.
We can only imagine.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, I guess, the analog to the different kinds of Pikmin, you know, blue, red, and yellow, and then later purple and white. But you basically don't have like such sophisticated resource management as Pikmin, in terms of like you can turn one villager into a different job whenever you like. Although the one thing that kind of discourages that is that they do sort of get better if they keep doing that job that they've been doing. They'll get more health and stuff. It's kind of, again, it's a bit like with Pikmin, where, you know, they'd have the bud would grow on their head and they'd become more effective. So, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between the two, but visually it's quite different. It's sort of a bit of a, it's a bit more close to a kind of Animal Crossing kind of look, because obviously Pikmin has these kind of very super detailed kind of textures, or certainly were for the time, you know, when the first one came out,
right?
With these little cartoon characters, whereas this is more sort of generally cartoon.
You know, it had to be detailed because they had to get the Duracell logo in there.
Well, that was only even the second one they got around to all the product placement. But, you know, with this, it's got this fairy tale vibe going on. It kind of embellishes that. It's all full of very recognizable classical music, different arrangements of classical music. You'll hear Beethoven's Ninth, Land of Hope and Glory, all sorts of stuff. That's nice. It's a nice touch, although I kind of find it hard to take Beethoven's Ninth as kind of this symbol of rural idyllic life after the way it was used in Clockwork Orange or even Die Hard. It's just, you know, I'm not thinking about people sort of going about their business blissfully. I'm thinking about Hans Gruber getting dropped off. What was the name of the building? Nakatomi Plaza or whatever. Yeah, there's your action. There's your action movie trivia.
Well done.
So, but like, the way it kind of handles stuff with the controls is it works. You know, I mean, it's you do feel a bit of a shame that it's not making use of the pointer because it seems like such a good idea, and people seem to think that it does work really well with the new play control Pikmin, which I haven't played myself, and I assume no one else has here.
No, I have not.
Pikmin controls, no, but I've spoken to you half.
Yeah, I mean, generally it seems like, you know, even though those games were not designed with it in mind, they work pretty well, and then you've got a new game.
It always felt like those games were designed for it in mind. I mean, that was the first.
Yeah, they were.
That was the first Nintendo game that popped into my mind.
They were kind of pushing what you could do with the analog stick a bit. I mean, it worked fine with the controller, like the way they did that. And with this, you're not managing, at least for now, you're certainly not managing as many things. Like, you know, you start off being able to control just 5 villagers, and you have to spend some of your money that you get from treasure and stuff to actually upgrade how many villagers you could take with you.
So is this like junior feudalism?
Yeah. There's a kind of a bit of a sim kind of game too in terms of like creating your kingdom. But it's not really like sophisticated management of that. It's more just a case of choosing what to build. You don't have to like place it in particular or anything like that. It kind of builds out across a sort of fixed kind of path. So it's a kind of linear, it's kind of just a progression kind of game. And as the game goes on, what happens is that you've got a bit of this kind of accumulation thing, like an Animal Crossing, but not as customizable. In terms of once you kind of engage with other kingdoms and defeat their kings, who are like the bosses in the game, then you kind of like import their technology and stuff. And your
It's imperialism.
Yeah, and your kingdom becomes richer, and your throne room gets bigger, and you actually start to collect wives from...
I'm not sure I like the morals this game is giving to our children.
You gradually sort of just build up this collection of all the maidens from the other kingdom.
What the fuck, man?
Are they just, all sit in a room, or...?
Like I said, I haven't gotten to the point in that I've played the first few hours, so I haven't gotten to this point.
So can we conclude that the little king of his story is a dick?
Little King Big Love Story is what it should be called. Yeah.
There's some dick in there, all right.
Jesus Christ, John.
I'm just saying.
By the way, this you would never expect it from looking at the box art, but after you described it, I went to see what the ESRB rated it. They gave it a T for teen, which they'd have to because Jesus fucking Christ.
You have a harem.
This asshole story.
It got 7+ in Europe. That's strange.
Well, I guess they're more open about love and imperialism.
Yeah, they do in Europe. They're pretty crazy.
Oh, yeah, we're all about polygamy over here.
It's the historical simulation in Europe.
We're a lot looser over there. What can you say?
Yeah. But it's definitely quite fun so far. It's quite a unique sort of blend, even though it's a lot like Pikmin in the sort of the raw mechanics of it. I think the trappings and the kind of progression is a bit different, and definitely the atmosphere is quite different. It's sort of charming in quite a different way.
There's a very disturbing image out there of this game with this context in mind now, of the king sitting on his throne and this little girl in front of him looks like it's about his age, and the corners are covered with twinkling roses now. Yeah. It sticks on a whole new meaning.
Yeah, it's that but there is some weird stuff. There's like a sort of priest guy that you meet quite early in the game that's like, build me a church or God will punish you. Or I will punish you.
So is this the reason why Marvelous isn't publishing it?
Well, yeah, so like, was it, over here, it's published by Rising Star Games that does pretty much everything Marvelous. But yeah, this did get picked up in America by Xseed, who published quite a lot of Marvelous games, even though they lost Muramasa recently to Ignition. But they will be publishing Little King Story in America in June, I believe. So for some reason, Europe got this first, but there is a downside. It does not run in 60Hz mode, which is really quite annoying, but...
This is a disturbing trend here, isn't it?
There is a big difference between...
It
is a big
World.
Difference between that and Mad World from the point of view that it's not bordered. So it's not as bad in that sense. The downside with it there is just that because it's not at 60Hz, but the game speed is kind of like is the same, what happens is you get a bit of this kind of... It looks kind of skippy. It looks because you are effectively skipping frames out.
Right.
Yeah, it does look a bit sort of disjointed sometimes. But the thing is, it's quite a slow-paced game. It's not really fluid. You're most of the time quite zoomed out and stuff. It's annoying, especially because stuff that isn't progressive scan tends to look quite bad on HD TVs. But it's more tolerable to me than Mad World, so I decided to keep it. I was prudent this time because I looked at the back of the box and there was no 60 hertz supported logo on it.
Wasn't this after you already bought it though, before you opened it?
It was before I opened it, yeah. I still had the chance to return it and get my money back, no questions asked. So I was like, I waited for the reports to filter in on from forums and stuff about the extent of how bad it was, and then whenever realised there weren't any borders, I thought I'll go for it because I haven't really bought many Wii games in a while. I bought Mad World and didn't play it, so I didn't want to do that again. It just would have been so bad.
All right, I'm reading a story on CVG about this game from the game's developer Yasuhiro Wada.
Yeah, it's quite a sort of dream team of developers that came together to make it. You've got guys for obviously, I think primarily the guy from that's done stuff like Harvest Moon, but also people that have been involved in Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. There is a certain pedigree behind it.
Well, he has a quote in here that now is hilarious. Quote, single player life sim set in Europe. So what life are they simulating in Europe? And where the fuck do I need to move to be involved in that life?
It's very, very strange. But, it seems like it's really quite good. It's quite a long game. I'll probably come back to it, talk about it when I've played more of it in a couple of weeks. I might try and write a review. I haven't got the most time to do that, but I would like to get that up because it's still quite a while before it comes out in America.
Yeah, I think end of June is what it's set for in America.
So I look forward to that. And James, you can close us out for new business.
So I wasn't originally going to talk about it, but after John brought up GTA Chinatown Wars, I actually got GTA 4 during one of Blockbuster's amazing clean-out sales.
Well,
I have to say, if you have a Blockbuster nearby, it doesn't hurt to go check out their used game selection because they're always selling cheaper than the used game stores because they're not really looking to make a profit on it. And the boxes and manuals and stuff, the game's immediately taken out of the box the minute they get it and put in one of the little proprietary boxes. So all that stuff is fucking magnificent condition. Like, it's brand new. Mm-hmm. So I got GTA 4 basically brand new for $15.
Wow. Yeah, because, I mean, normally, I mean, I'm used to, GameStop, where, they pretty much, piss on the manual and then hand it to you.
The manual was so new that it still had the giant map that comes with it, and the creases were still crisp.
Wow.
Like no one's ever going to open that manual. And so $15 for that's not bad at all. So it's kind of funny because I'm actually just started playing it yesterday. So I'm kind of seeing what John saw in reverse, where I'm seeing elements of Chinatown Wars that I'm like, oh my god, it's just like this in the console game. They really did squeeze a lot into a handheld.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
They're going back thinking, this game was praised for having everything in it, but so far, Chinatown Wars has all this in it too.
Yeah.
Holy shit. But I was really planning on talking about that next week, so I'm going to kind of shelve that.
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of content.
The game I've really poured attention to this week was Army of Two, which is an EA game that came out, a year ago?
Yeah.
A little less than
I think last summer?
Yeah. If you enjoy your commentary on private military contractors, you'll get a kick out of this game. But it's actually, it's not.
Didn't MGS4 have a lot of that in it?
I'm sure it does. It's not
private military.
But probably a little from a different perspective than.
Yes, it's not the first game to do what it does, where essentially you have to use a partner to get through all the missions. But it does it in maybe not a unique way, but in a fully developed way that is very exciting in a way. So basically, the entire game comes down to one long strategy session with your partner.
Mm.
So in the single player, you basically give orders to your partner, and he tries to follow them with his brain not functioning quite properly. But about 90% of the time, he does what you want him to do, which for giving orders to partners in a game is pretty high compared to what we're used to. But there's a lot of strategy in how you use him versus yourself, how you equip yourself. Basically, you can't win this game unless you can do things like distract enemies while one person moves around, or lots of little things like that. and it ends up making the game feel almost like you're playing it with a second person.
Right.
Even though you aren't. And it's like not even a dumbass. Like you're playing it with someone who actually knows what the fuck they're doing.
Well, it's kind of, you would hope that would be the case when you're talking about building a game around, you know, yeah. It's not just like an extra mode. It's like the whole game is built around that. But the thing is, RE5, apparently that is not so much the case. So.
No, it's not.
Well, with Army of Two, they had like the specific AI for it.
Right.
Developed and, for it within mind.
And apparently the I played it as one of the two characters you get to pick, but apparently the two characters do behave somewhat differently depending on which one's AI controlled.
Mm.
And their interactions are, to say the least, amusing. There's a whole mechanic in the game where you have to congratulate your partner every time y'all get through something crazy. So you walk up to them and you hit on the 360 the A button, and they'll do some dumbass infantile thing like they'll take their guitars. Sorry, they'll take their guns and play them like
air guitars.
They'll take their guns and play them like air guitars, and then they'll like throw up devil horns and make guitars.
That rock and roll climber or whatever that got unveiled at GDC.
Oh hell
He just gets to the top of the thing and then whips his guitar out. Hence why it's called rock and roll climber.
There you go.
The whole game hinges
so
on the,
random.
The whole game hinges on the concept.
But the whole game plays off like a 10-year-old's infantile fantasy of war. So basically,
oh god! So you tell me it's every negative stereotype of video games.
well, no, because everybody's white, basically. But
yeah,
but it's got like your big muscle-bound super soldiers that basically walk through and shoot everything that moves without getting hurt.
Yeah, so it's like Gears of War.
Well, except for the fact it's other people. And the entire game is basically told through combat. There's not a lot of there is video, but it's not really all that relevant to the story. So it's the dialogue that moves the game along, and you know that's nice. I haven't really had that feeling since the original Prince of Persia game on the GameCube. That you really felt like you were interacting with something.
Is this a rivalry for the best love story ever told by video?
There is a little bit of gayness there. It does sometimes feel this is getting into a little bit beyond bromance here.
So let's crystallize it, more or less than Top Gun.
Oh, less, much less.
Okay,
that's full on gay romance.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they try to distract you with Kelly McGillis, so I'm not fooled.
No, well, you know, what can you say? It was a valiant effort. It's funny though, because the game. It, not only does it actually play like you would want a game to play where you're trying to, you know, have a partner that's... Without him, you will lose this game.
Yeah, so they're filled in the sense of dependency and interdependency.
And,
you know, that.
Well, it comes down to the level design and the actual AI of the enemies. It's not just they built a good AI. They then took the AI they built and designed good levels around it.
Yeah, so it's coherent and it's, you know, sort of not token, the whole co-op element there.
Actually, and completely unrelated back to what you just said, it's funny you mentioned Top Gun, because guess who came out as a lesbian today? Kelly McGillis came out as a lesbian.
Really?
I'm not
kidding. So what you say, there is no facet of that film that is not homosexual?
It's official.
I swear to God, I am not kidding. I am looking at the news page right now, and I am seeing the headline. And I just looked at it, I went, holy shit, what the fuck?
I'll tell you what, if I find out that Michael Ironside's gay, I quit.
Yeah, seriously, I quit life at that point.
One other thing I want to point out about this game is that apparently it has a very robust co-op mode, where you can basically play the whole game in co-op.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, well, I get that. That definitely makes sense. I mean, you would certainly hope so. However good the AI is, so you'd be feeling pretty gypped if you couldn't do it.
The game is amazingly short. It's 7 hours maybe, but it's a very fun ride for that 7 hours.
Right. All right, well, before we take a break, I'm going to clear up something for the record. Now, you may have noticed it's been several weeks since we ever covered VC Mondays or DLC Mondays, whatever we were calling it. Of course, these days you've got DSI stuff and all that. And it was quietly shelved, basically because the amount of it that was dominated by new games now, like the extent to which the virtual console kind of got sidelined, meant that most of the time we had no idea.
And they were terrible. They were usually like Block Breaker Deluxe.
We had no idea what they were. So
which devolved
really...
into breaking blocks.
We couldn't really offer any meaningful insight on them, but just perhaps to read from the press release.
Which basically just meant we mocked the game based completely on its title.
On absolutely nothing, yeah.
With no basis.
Yeah, so that kind of has been shelved these days, and it's only more so the case with DSiWare now, but... Every now and again, we will make an exception to mention it, and that is because in this week's case, something very special come out that I think we've all been looking forward to for several months, which is Kokoto Platform Jumper.
Yes!
Yes!
I want to point out right now, I have no clue what this game is about.
Just the title alone just blows me away.
There's Kokoto, there's a platform, there's jumping. What's not to like?
I mean, it's so simple but so powerful.
The reason why this is long awaited, for me anyway, is if you cast your mind back, approximately 41 episodes, you'll find that this was in fact foretold.
Okay, now...
I want to point out, apparently, Kokoto is apparently a franchise in Europe. So, Greg, you're...
In Europe?
Yeah, I know all about that.
And the first game in the series is called Kokoto Platform Jumper.
So, wait a minute. So, what you're telling me is Kokoto's like a Renaissance man? Is that what you're telling me?
Sounds like it.
He jumps.
Kokoto Milk Delivery Man.
I've got the other ones at the bottom of the page. Kokoto Kart Racer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of
Kokoto
course.
Fun Fair. Kokoto Fishing Master and Kokoto Tennis Master.
Wow, nice. And do you think in each of these he has to save the world from the magic cauldron boiling over?
I think so.
Sometimes it's not quite as important as that.
He's a prophet. Features editor and prophet.
You know what? You're not the first person to say that, John.
The first of which was Kokoto Platform Jumper. So this is where it all started. And you know what the funny thing is? Is that looking at it, it does have the same plot as when he's a fishing master.
Shut up!
They both involve him trying to stop a cauldron full of lava from overflowing.
How dare you! Somebody get him!
So in one case, he has to fish to stop the cauldron. In the other case, he has to climb stairs.
What's next? I mean, where else can you go?
Yeah, presumably when he plays tennis and races carts and all this other... complete balls that he's been doing. It's all about the cauldron. All
right, match point. If he doesn't get this, the cauldron's going to overflow.
Fault. It's a bit of a conflict of interest there. If the umpire calls double fault, he does burn to death in magma. So he has an incentive to not call double fault and actually rig the game. I mean, the whole thing's a farce.
Well, remember, it's not rigging the game. It's like the NBA. You don't call that in the last minute of the game.
So yeah, it's been about 10 months since that fateful episode 103, and
fateful. So if you're feeling down, go listen, because you realize some people have it worse than you.
Yeah, your self-esteem is probably going to be somewhat burnished, although your faith in humanity will take a hit, so just balance that out.
And... I believe I was actually listening to episode 103 when I was on the set of Transformers last summer. I was an extra in it. So, that 103 is going places. Yeah. Shia LaBeouf almost
terrible places.
All right, well, that is definitely going to take us to the break, so... Afterwards, we're going to get to listener mail again, and then finally, the long-awaited or dreaded, depending on your point of view, retroactive or super ghouls and ghosts.
Yes.
So join us for that.
Super. Thank you.
And we're back, and we're going to go straight into listener mail. John, you have the first one.
All right, JP in Erie, Pennsylvania writes, as everyone on the forums knows, I buy way too many Virtual Console and WiiWare games. My question for you is this. Are there any VC or WiiWare games that caught your interest but that you passed on to avoid clearing out the fridge that you might consider going back and downloading now that space is no longer an issue? Gentlemen?
Yeah, so we talked about this at the time and things. It's definitely an issue in my mind. But we'll start sort of talking about some of the games that we've actually got that are really quite large. That other people might not have a sort of means of recommendation. The first one that comes to mind for me, Sin and Punishment. I think it's one of the biggest virtual console games.
Yeah, it is.
It's actually, with the SD card being out there, I actually played that game for the first time in a long time just because I had it sitting on my SD card.
Yeah, and because that's the other side of the coin in terms of this download, but also just actually playing it.
I got it when it came out because I never played Sin and Punishment before, and I played through it and I enjoyed it a lot, but then it just sat on my SD card, and now I was, after the update, I looked at it and was like, oh yeah, Sin and Punishment, I remember having a lot of fun with that, and I played through it again.
Yeah, that's true, because there always would have been a tendency to kind of, you know, if you don't really need something around on your Wii, to sort of shuffle it off to the SD card, but then it's so inaccessible, you're just not going to do anything with it, whereas now it's much more a case of just, yeah, like you see, you might just browse through and think, you know, oh yeah, I remember that, and just give it a go.
Yeah, I played on a lot of my N64 games.
Yeah, N64 games are generally pretty big. Another one along those lines, Paper Mario.
Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, I mean, you guys don't have Majora's Mask yet, do you? Because I'm sure that'll be another
game. I'm really looking forward to that because I've never played that game.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are in that, but that'll definitely be another one.
It really is a fantastic game.
Now, John, I know you have a really big downloadable game. Can you guess what it is?
What, Lords of Thunder?
No. That is large. Good. Well, good. It's good, but it's not right.
Oh, Choniki?
You know what else is large?
Choniki.
For next retroactive, Choniki.
It's large in so many ways. It's amazing.
Large and in charge.
Take the bait. Go on. because the thing with Choniki, like Lords of Thunder, it's a turbo CD game. So they're compressed down from what they would have been originally, but they're still pretty big.
Well, the one thing I will say, that, you know, like, the first time I actually got it, I was like, hey, you know what, size matters.
John's still laughing about big jokes right now, and he will continue to laugh until the end of this
but
segment.
See, now size doesn't matter anymore, so there you go. It's awesome.
It's perfectly justified, considering doesn't Choniki roughly translate to like Super Big Brothers or something? It is literally
something,
it has size in the name,
something like
and,
that.
But the point is, it is one less size excuse to not have Choniki. So
There weren't any excuses anyway.
Absolutely, there were none.
Well, I'm waiting for the retroactive. Once it wins retroactive, I'm getting Choniki. But until then.
That'd be the final straw. You just absolutely have to have it at that point.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing I will say just on that topic, just as an aside, I put out a call on the forums if somebody could find me a t-shirt of some sort for that game. And there was actually one out there. I forget which site it was on, but I will say that it was sold out.
Awesome.
So, yes, there's an underground cult Choniki army.
Some more ones that kind of more literally answer this question for me. I know Grooving Blocks, which Johnny has talked about.
World of Goo, obviously, is huge.
Oh, yeah, World of Goo is big. I think World of Goo is so roundly praised, people kind of made the space for it. I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Sam Max games are quite large.
Well, it's a very important sort of, it's a good reference point because they sent, Telltale sent out a press release like shortly after the update went out saying our sales have doubled or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, some sort of magnitude.
And we didn't make the jump for them. They quite willingly made the jump themselves just because of
No, it's just like, well, look, this update has happened and our sales have gone up by this much percent. I mean, it's, you know, it is very clear causal link there and, you know, they were pretty big too, each part.
It was, and if you have the whole set, well, then your entire Wii memory's fucked.
I mean, yeah,
yeah. I don't think you would have even necessarily been able to do it, or at least you wouldn't if you'd had any reasonable amount of other stuff on there. So again, that's a good, it's a good point. Neil, any particular suggestions or?
Well, that's a recent one. That's another one that got a lot of praise though. But even Space Invaders Get Even, which came out at the end of last year, kind of a little to no fanfare just because of how much space it took up with all the DLC. But now you can get all of that without any problem.
That you're kind of buying that in installments, aren't you? So it's a bit of a Strong Bad type situation.
Like, that game's like paying your mortgage. You slowly get more and more of it as you pay.
Yeah, the one thing to note about that is that I don't think you can actually play the DLC off of the SD card directly. You have to copy
it
over.
No, you cannot.
Oh, really?
Yep.
No, DLC has to be on the game system itself.
Yeah. Yep, so you have to have it all on your Wii system memory.
This applies to all games, including what my suggestion for that one would be, which is the Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles.
Yeah, that was actually one I'm thinking of picking up.
Yeah, and I suppose it gets slightly larger, but they're not big like files.
No, the DLC
because they're unlocks. They're unlocks.
Yeah,
there are a couple of blocks of pieces.
I think there might be one that's real content download, and then of course you have two big WiiWare titles. Kukto Platform Jumper, which was a GameCube title at one point, so of course it's quite
valid. It's a classic.
And then you have the all-important Kukto Fishing Master.
Mm-hmm.
Even better.
That is 600 blocks of goodness there.
Kukto goodness.
600 blocks on a Wii disc and you might just stop that fucking cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
At least until the next one comes out.
A couple of more recent ones I think. Onslaught is I haven't really been toying with this that much, but I mean it was like totally out of the question beforehand.
Yeah, it's gigantic
because it's a big one, isn't it, John?
It's something. It's like 280 blocks or something like that.
Jesus Christ,
it's huge. It's probably the second biggest I have next to World of Goo.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll kind of close this out just by saying I really hope, though, that it does instigate a bigger download cap on the size, you know, on the size of the games, hopefully, having this. Because, I mean, for instance, was it Marvel vs. Capcom 2 is coming to Xbox Live and all that?
But
it's just too big. To be on WiiWare.
Yes.
I don't know whether it's be like even with the SD card, it might be a bit too much on the large side. But you know the things like that would be really cool if they could do it.
Thinking of another launch title, you got Lost Winds too, which I think was
you're right. That was definitely. I still haven't got that.
For the sequel.
That's true. All right, well we'll move on. I've got the next question. This is from TJ Spike in Rochester, New York. And he said, I was wondering if you guys know why Virtual Console has yet to have any third-party N64 games nearly 2.5 years after it started. I know it didn't have huge amounts of support from third parties, but still got a pretty good amount, and many of them would have no problem being released on the Virtual Console. It is a little odd.
Dickism.
Because, I mean, well, first of all, is there a particular third-party game that anybody really wants for the N64? I guess
you know what, Beetle Adventure Racing.
Yeah, that's about it.
Goemon.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Mystical Ninja.
Would Blast Corps? Would that be considered third-party, or would that be second-party?
No.
That was published by Nintendo, right?
Yeah, I guess it was second-party. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I guess it at least would be second-party in terms of if it wasn't technically published by Nintendo, but Nintendo owned a significant part of the company that did publish it, but they don't anymore.
Nintendo did publish Blast Corps,
The Rare games is a little long. Some were, some weren't, in terms of what was published by Nintendo. But certainly, yeah, I mean, the Rare games, you know, are probably one of the biggest examples that people would want, that's whether you deem it technically a third party or not. But of course, they have this whole separate legal sort of web to deal with. Yeah, what he means when he says many of them would have no problem being released on the VC is, I think that's what he's saying, is not like a Rare situation.
How do you define a problem? I mean,
well, there's not like you would have to like update a license, or you would have to do anything like that.
Well, that's like the Mystical Ninja starring Goemon and then Goemon's Great Adventure. They're both, we already have Mystical Ninja game that was released in America, and then all the other ones that came out in Japan.
Too. Yeah, that's right. But so we don't have
that one.
I mean, that's the thing. It's not the easiest to record. I know my N64 collection was absolutely dominated by Nintendo and Rare stuff.
Yeah, so everybody's was really.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I could think of the acclaim stuff. You know, like Turok and all that. But I'm not sure how. Obviously, that has its own problems with what's happening.
Well, you know, if they didn't continually re-release this game, I would say Harvest Moon 64 would be a good candidate, but since the Harvest Moon games since then haven't done much past that iteration, unless you move into their new sub-franchise.
And that's another one where we have the Super Nintendo version too.
There's a number of those where, like you said, you've got versions in those franchises from those publishers on other platforms on the Virtual Console, and they're notably absent on the N64.
Well, there's only like 10 games on Virtual Console from N64 anyway.
I think it is in the teens at most, isn't it? Or maybe in Japan it's in the teens because they've got Smash Brothers and Majora's Mask, but I think, to me the only thing I could think of really is just that making a N64 Virtual Console game is somehow more of an undertaking in terms of the costs involved.
I think it comes down to what we discussed last week and we've discussed before, the fact that you might really have to develop like an emulator add-on to the ROM.
There's just more to it.
N64 is such a very strange piece of hardware, and it was very cartridge driven.
And I guess they probably feel, you know, because of the way the N64 was at the time, you know, that it might be very difficult to actually get the sales back because, you know, people didn't buy those games at the time. They don't necessarily have the nostalgia for them. The same kind of buzz, you know, you do for when a Nintendo game comes out that people bought in significant quantities, you know, during the late 90s or whatever.
Because if you ask somebody what was their favorite N64 game, it's going to be one of maybe four, and all of them are Nintendo published.
It's going to be
Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, Mario 64, GoldenEye,
Smash Brothers,
maybe Mario.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them, but they are so dominant. So I guess that I really have to look at it, you know, as ever. It's probably just simply a risk reward, you know, cost benefit thing of like, you know, compared with the other platforms, it's probably quite a lot more costly to do, and then compared with the other platforms, it's probably not as much of a fan base necessarily to actually sort of buy, you know, to actually buy into it. So I guess that's how that balances out. And TJ Spike had another question. He said, I've heard rumours that Nintendo set quotas in each region for games regarding Virtual Console and WiiWare sales, that developers don't receive any money for a game until it reaches that quota. Is this true? Well, since the original report of that came out, there was something else. Some anonymous developer source kind of came out and said, well, yeah, this is kind of how it works, and so we've got reason to believe that this is basically how things work. But
yeah,
there's been no denial yet.
The threshold, as we understand, is quite low. You know, it's in the like
4,000.
It's variable by what we some of the details we've heard. Again, these are difficult to verify. Obviously,
all we can do is that the original reporter verifies the source. Really,
yeah. So you're kind of taking it for granted a little bit. But basically, it varies by size, the amount. But yeah, as you said, like, you've got it varies by region because the markets are different size. But you're talking about maybe 4,000 or 6,000, or, you know, these kinds of levels is where they are.
And it's not a hard and fast Nintendo gets all the money either. In some cases,
what we've heard is that once that threshold is passed, you then get the developer would then get paid for all the sales beneath that threshold, and the split overall is, I think, 65 to the developer, then 35 to Nintendo. So that's how it works, and if we take these reports as accurate. And if we've talked about Nintendo being very hands-off before, but I guess this is what we didn't know before, that this is their one mechanism for not having it flooded with, you know, abysmal, sort of very cynical kind of cash in, trying to make a bit of money off like maybe 100 downloads or something because it's so cheap to develop in the first place. So I guess the main thing that I take from this is that, you know, I don't think it's some sort of like terrible Nintendo restriction or whatever. It doesn't sound particularly obtrusive. You know, I would that threshold would probably be passed fairly quickly by most games that have, you know, some sort of that have some sort of merit to them. But
even Fishing Master probably.
Platform
Jumper is going to bust that number.
And I also believe that we've heard that they have a significant period of time to reach this threshold, like a matter of years to actually do it. Which, of course, if it does take you years to do it, means it takes you years to get paid.
You've already gone bankrupt, probably.
But, you know, I mean, it's so... I guess the point is, though, that, you know, this is sort of Nintendo's one way of kind of, you know, putting a bit of a dam on what goes into WiiWare. And, you know, it seems fair enough to me, to be honest. I mean, they get a decent split at the end of the day and they get paid on those back units, you know, once they pass it. So I think it might have been a little, you know, there's a tendency to react to it like it's some terrible draconian thing.
Well, we expect Nintendo to screw publishers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just something they did for so long, so thoroughly.
Well, the point is, it's nothing compared to the old, you know, the practices.
It's not. And it's just... people who followed them for a long time are conditioned to it. You know, we expect Nintendo to go in and be like, all right, here's the deal. We're going to take 80% of the money. You're only allowed to release 2 games a year, and we get to pick those games. Now, if we don't approve of any of the games you've given to us to approve, you won't get to release the requisite number of games. You cannot sell your quota. We might sell your quota to another party.
You know, I think it's purely a matter of a kind of indirect quality control measure and probably and quantity as well. You know, it will address that as well.
But I think we have their bizarro system of determining when a game gets released. I think that might actually be some backdoor quality control.
Yeah, there's probably some of that as well, yeah. So,
they'll say, yeah, well, we're still working on your game getting it released. And they're back at Trios going, what a piece of shit.
They're just saving it for that week where they really do have nothing else.
All right, guys. We've got Kokoto Platform Jumper. Jesus.
Oh, come on. Help us. We're piling on Kokoto a little much, so I'm feeling bad for the little guy.
You're such a softy, Greg.
I know, I'm sentimental old chap.
You people unleashed him on this world, you would feel sorry for him.
Yeah, well, not really. we'll move on to the next question, James. You've got this one.
So, Sophia writes, my question is a bit of a retrospective. Oh, boy. Back before the internet was rampant with easily attainable facts,
this should be a quotation mark next to facts there. Actually, facts. Attainable facts.
Quotation mark facts. Close quotation. Comma. Well, actually, the comma.
The comma comes before the quotation.
Yes. Thank you, John.
AP style.
John has to learn.
Deal.
AP style, Neil. All right. So, what BS quote secret codes quote did you guys fall for? ? For example, this could include finding Yoshi by jumping through the waterfall in Super Mario 64 just right. Were there any cheats that you were in fact real that shocked you? A personal favorite of mine was in Shadows of the Empire, where you could take control over enemy characters. I want to point out that my favorite Shadows of the Empire code was the ability to fall through the floor and kill bosses where they couldn't get you because you're fucking under
them. That's some great testing right there.
There's a couple that have been discussed previously, like the Naboo fighter.
That was an amazing code.
In Rogue Squadron, because what's shocking about it is that they kind of risked, like, you know, with all the secrecy or whatever around the film, that they actually sort of risked, like, having that in the game, like, for the whole time. Because Rogue Squadron came out a considerable amount of time before.
2 years.
I don't think it was 2 years, but it was.
It was
something between like a year and 6 months or something like that. It was.
Yeah, I think it made. Did it come out in 98? Because I know episode one came out in 99.
I think it. Yeah, episode one came out in May 99 in America, and I think it came out at the end of 98. I want to say Rogue Squadron. So
yeah, probably holiday.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge. But like with the lead in on development and all that, you know, the information sharing that would have gone into that is quite shocking and quite cool. That it, you know, it just seems like such a load of crap that they would put it, like, you know, that mag, because obviously we found out about it when episode one had come out. So it seemed like the kind of thing that, you know, a games magazine or whatever at the time would have, like, come up with, like, oh, yeah, you know that thing that's in episode one now? You could do that, honest.
Well, you know, it's because, I mean, the code for putting it in was so difficult to find.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
In fact, there was no chime when you got it right. and you had to enter like 5 codes in a row or something like that. So the only way that was getting out was a leak.
It was super, super secret. But you know, but to be for people got to hack the game or something. I don't know, something. But I don't know how much that went on with the N64.
There were codes in that game that people were finding. So I'm surprised someone didn't hack the game, because with the Game Shark back then, you could hook it up to your PC, hook the game into that, and then just fuck around with it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why it surprised me, and it was definitely cool. So that was a real one that was cool. Another one was that surprised me was the, I've talked about Radio Trivia, was the Turok 2 code, where you could basically end up playing split screen in the multi in the single player, which completely broke the game. But it's just surprising that worked in a way at all. There were a lot of codes for those Acclaim games, but that was definitely one that was kind of interesting. But in terms of the main thrust, like dodgy ones, anything?
Oh, the Pokemon ones, obviously.
All right, Pokemon.
The million ways you can quote find Mew in the original.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember my little 10-year-old self going through everything that I could find.
There was the truck that just sits there that you can't get to unless you surf to get to it.
Yep.
Near the boat, where supposedly if you use
strength,
so many
hours
to push
wasted.
It, You did it enough times, you would get Mew or something.
There was another one, like sort of the thing about this, it did have some substance in it. It was the whole thing about having all the different bonds in GoldenEye, because people did use a Game Shark or an Action Replay or whatever to show that the photos of like Timothy Dalton and Roger Moore and Connery and all that were in the game, but
they were all pulled.
And
there was no.
But
code.
They were pulled, so there wasn't an actual like legitimate GoldenEye cheat code to play as those characters. Yeah. But
wasn't there also an extra stage in there?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was an extra stage. It was like a. It was like an Aztec temple or something.
Well, wasn't it like, you know, the last level where you fought, you had the golden gun and you fought Baron Samedi? Wasn't that like you could play? No, you could unlock that anyway.
Those were both in multiplayer.
Yeah, they were in multiplayer anyway.
There was like some hidden, like something, kind of like an underground bunker or something like that.
Yeah, so with GoldenEye, there was all sorts of stuff, you know, but you'd get, what would happen is because there was a shred of truth in it, people would then take that and get, you know, create bullshit ways of trying to get it.
Yeah,
you know, so a bit like with the Triforce Hunt, you know, because there were screenshots of the Triforce from early versions of Zelda 64, you know, people would come up with total nonsense to how you could get it.
There's your answer, John. It was the Citadel.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because the thing is, people loved GoldenEye so much, like kind of like with Ocarina. You know, there was a lot of like fertile ground for that kind of crap. And one thing I remember though more from the old days, the magazine days and stuff, was like not so much like the codes, which I'm sure there were plenty of fake ones, but fake games was a big thing. Like I remember someone put like a whole thing about, I guess April Fools and stuff, you know, it still goes on, but someone did a whole thing about there being a version of Mario Kart on the Game Boy. You know, the monochrome.
Right.
Boy, and just basically just took a bunch of Super NES shots and turned them into monochrome.
Oh yeah. And this the Sonic and Smash Brothers melee.
Yeah, Sonic and Tails.
Yes, that people killed themselves trying to do that. What was it? The Super Melee? I mean,
I think it was like Cruel Mutant.
Yeah, I tried that, even though I realized it was their April Fool. Just to see if it was even possible to complete that objective. I think I got within like one kill before I lost. And I just went like, nope, can't be done. And then just walked away.
They kind of incorporated that into those challenges in Brawl, basically. Yeah. Some of those are pretty bloody hard. Yeah. So, I mean, it's something that doesn't tend to go on as much now, even with all the kind of, like, nonsense.
Yeah, there doesn't really seem to be a lot of cheats, period, in games.
It's kind of almost been incorporated into game design, really, because, like, you know, now
unlockables
you have unlockables and, like, you know, extra content and achievements. So it's kind of funny that it's, like, evolved into that, into, like, a legitimate part of the design of every game now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, all right, we'll move on now into... Retroactive number 5, Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Woo! I know everyone's been looking forward to this, especially Johnny, as he is...
Johnny is actually not here because of his hatred for this game.
Yeah.
That's somewhat overstating it. But
yeah, but, well, his, he does really have the back of the box quote of the year for this game, I think.
Pretty uncharitable.
Yeah, his I think his words, if I recall, were, yeah, this game can go itself. That's those are his exact words.
It's a it's funny how people just absolutely hate this game for its difficulty.
Yeah, this is a polarizing game, so I guess to set up our discussion of it, therefore, it's
we are the absolute wrong crowd to represent.
It is appropriate for us to set up the context for our knowledge of this game, our experience of the game. So, John, I'm going to start with you. What is your experience with the series in general, you know, Ghosts and Goblins, Ghouls and Ghosts, and then this game specifically?
Well, you know, this is opening myself, you know, wide up for a, you know,
I'll step aside. I won't say anything. I'll be good.
Can we have an amnesty on the age jokes, please? Ceasefire.
Well, my history with this series, and well, this game and the series in general goes way back, because I'm not too sure when Ghosts and Goblins came out. It was probably about 86, maybe 87.
It depends what version, I guess.
Yeah.
What version did you get?
Well,
that's
the thing. I used to play it on the
did
Commodore
you play
64,
the arcade?
But that was obviously after the arcade, which was probably about it's probably like 85, 86. It was way back there. But yeah, that's where I first started playing that, and you know, I was a fan of this series ever since. And so, you know, this is actually, I mean, I owned probably about maybe between 10 and 12 games for the Super NES, and this is one of them. And so, you know,
really?
Obviously...
Really? That few? I'm shocked. I'm quite shocked that it was that few.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I didn't have much money back then. I mean, I actually had to pay for my games. So, but yeah, like this. So this is one of the games, you know, this is obviously one of the ones that I thought highly enough of to actually purchase.
And it was quite an early Super NES game. I think it was at the end of 1991 in Japan. And so when did you get your hands on it?
Right around when it came out. If I recall correctly, it was... I think it was probably around the time when like ActRaiser came out. I think it was around that time. It was one of those early titles.
Ooh, that's a tough choice there, man.
Well, that's the thing. See, back then, I mean, ActRaiser, that wasn't a known brand. I didn't know anything about that game.
Yeah,
no, I mean it got really great reviews, but you had to be really tuned in to know that.
Yeah,
that definitely.
I mean,
didn't have the heritage.
I never really heard of ActRaiser until when I was getting my Super Nintendo collection when I was younger in like the late 90s.
Right.
I happened to find it in a store and it was cheaper, and I was like, "Oh, Enix? Yeah, I'll try it. It's really good."
Yeah.
But...
I still get upset that game has a sequel. I mean,
okay.
I mean,
I know you do,
terrible.
Too. So
physically.
That's not what we're going to do right here. So you played it at the time, and you were immediately enamored with it,
say? Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I was kind of, because I'd played the earlier games, I knew pretty much how incredibly hard it was. But back then, the thing is, that was okay, because there were games, you just kind of accepted that, right? Like a lot of the platforms were just like
that. That was gaming. If you played games during the NES, you were used to this.
Yeah,
which is not to say that this wasn't at the sort of top end.
No.
Because it was, at the time, it was sort of at the top end of difficulty, but...
There were other games there with it.
It wasn't, it wasn't some sort of crazy outlier.
No.
You know, there were other...
Yeah, it was just kind of how games were.
Yeah.
Yeah, to some extent. But, I mean, there are some interesting kind of peculiarities with it that we'll get into later on.
And in fact, there were games that went well beyond this that people just regarded as...
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure.
The thing is, there were games on the NES. I mean, when I play them now, I'm just like, how did anybody ever design this and think this was fun? This sucks. And these are classic games, right? Like,
fuck this game, man.
No, honestly, like I find them unplayable now.
There's some interesting issues that came up about. It's kind of like what we talked about Metroid, you know. We talked in the Super Metroid episode. Like, you know, Johnny and I would say, "Oh, you know, I find Metroid difficult to play." And then in the talk back to that, people would say, "Oh, well, you know, I find Metroid a lot easier to play than, say, like the 8-bit Castlevanias."
Mm-hmm.
And for me, who grew up with the 8-bit Castlevanias, that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think probably the main difference in that is that I played those when I was a kid, and I didn't play Metroid when I was a kid. kid. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the main difference, to be honest. It's probably just whether you are conditioned to that by playing them in early life. And for me, Super Ghouls and Ghosts is another one of those games. I had it at the end for Christmas in 1991 for the Super Famicom, you know, and you know, I just accepted it. That, you know, there was nothing particularly sort of unexpected about it. James, your history with the game?
My history is a bit more recent. I actually didn't own the game until substantially later. I played my cousin's copy of it, which was obnoxious because I'd get about 2 hours in and I'd have to stop because I'd have to go.
And we'll get to why that could be a problem.
Yes, yes, we will. But so I might be the only person here who's beaten the game. Which is a feat of just sheer perseverance.
Yeah, I have not beaten it.
Well, I've beaten it as well.
Have you beaten it all the way through the second time?
Yeah. I've done
okay,
it.
Okay, so...
It's especially, I mean, for anybody who's got it on Virtual Console or GBA...
Oh, that's true. You can save it.
It's easier from the point of view that you can save or suspend.
You can step away and pee, essentially.
Yeah, which obviously that's why it was such an issue with the Super NES, because you had to just have the system on the whole time.
Yes. And in fact, it was a double problem because where my SNES was, I couldn't leave it on. Because if I left it on, somebody was going to come through and turn it off because, quote, it's a waste of power.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, but I mean, I had the Super Famicom running through a step-down converter that you could boil eggs on that plug. If you had it on for once, it was kind of loath to leave that on if you didn't have to.
So, in fact, beating this game when it originally came out required either leaving it on and walking away and risk falling out of the zone, mm-hmm. as it were. Or, yeah. And it really did. This really was a game where when the time you beat it, you would not be able to replicate that the next time you played it. It really was kind of a zone to it.
Yeah, because it was more like you got into this like timing groove. That's what I find. Just you can time the jumps. You kind of know how everything feels. You know,
timing is a big part of this game for a number of reasons. But just to clarify, so you play when you're playing with your cousin. This was close to when it came out.
Yeah,
originally.
This was like 92, 93.
Right, and then later, and you actually had it for yourself.
Yeah, I got like 97.
Right, some years after that. Yeah. So, Neil, just to sort of finish us out...
Actually, the first time I ever owned the game was about a day and a half ago when I got on Virtual Console.
3 days ago, but then he actually went and undercut me by 50%.
But I've played the game before sparingly. I've had friends who've had it for Super Nintendo. A friend of mine has it on his Wii on Virtual Console, who he beat it recently, and I was talking to him about it when I was like, oh, I'm playing it. And he said that he could probably only get about 2 stages in, even though he has completely beaten the game, but he doesn't really have much urge to go back to the game.
It just goes back to what James was saying, in terms of you kind of have to be right in that. You have to be immersed in it, you know, to kind of, because it is very challenging and whatnot. So it's nice to have someone who's got a bit, we've kind of all got a similar experience, the three of us. Whereas Neil, you've got quite a different one. So
yeah, like I'm familiar with the game. It's just that I've never actually sat down and played it.
I do like that with us here, we are probably absolutely the wrong group to give both sides of the quote controversy on this game.
Yeah.
Well, there's still ways that we could explore it for sure. But I mean, we'll get into the other side of the story. How much we've been playing it now. For the feature, basically what I've done is I've played it on the GBA and I've played it on my Super Famicom cartridge because it still works. I've played through the first time. So just to be clear, the way this game works is you get to the end of the game. There are 7 stages, and it's quite a challenge and pretty long for a game of its type. You know, an arcade style game, even though it wasn't.
But even
though it wasn't literally an arcade game, it was. This was the first game in the series that was purely for a console. It was made exclusively for the Super Nintendo,
which they didn't apparently get the memo on when they made this game.
So, but it was still very much arcade style, and so you got to the end of the 7 stages, and then you sort of expected to, you know, either fight another boss or you would have rescued the princess that you're going after or whatever. And it's like, I forget exactly what it is. Isn't it like, I dropped my bracelet earlier, which is actually the key to defeating.
Your weapons will be no good against him. You need my bracelet that I dropped all the way back at the beginning of the game. I'm going to send you back there now. And then you're teleported back level 1, stage 1, screen 1, spot 1. And, yeah. And then the enemies start dropping her bracelet all over throughout the damn game.
Yeah, all of a sudden the bracelet is everywhere.
But see, here's the kicker. That means you have to have the bracelet when you get to the final boss the next time. If by some reason you've lost it by accidentally picking up another weapon, guess what happens?
You have to start all over?
No, you go back to the start of the seventh level.
Go back to the start
level.
Of the last stage, which is by far the most sadistic stage in the game.
Yeah, as you might expect, it ramps
but
it
no,
up.
But
a
I mean,
bit,
it's substantially more sadistic than the stage.
Well, there's a number of reasons why. We'll kind of get that into that. So yeah, that's how I played it through. I've played it. Yeah, I've beaten it before. I've played it many times, but I still went through to saw all the stages again. Got to play through them for the purposes of this. John, James,
I've gotten through the first five stages before I got unceremoniously executed.
Yeah, this time. I mean, the thing is, I mean, I've played this game so many times that, you know, I didn't feel like a rigorous playthrough was necessarily
needed
for this.
I mean, I know it by heart.
And so, I played it for probably about maybe an hour last night, and I got to the third stage. Yeah, I got to the third stage where you're going through
the fire stage,
fire.
The towers and the fire. So yeah, yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I know this game, you know, I know it very well, and that's the thing. I mean, it does make playing it very differently. It's very hard for me to put myself in that position of, you know, looking at this game, like how the difficulty works, how, you know, all of the gameplay of it works, from someone who isn't used to it, because for me, I just, you know, I could still remember like how to avoid death in this situation or this, that, and the other, you know.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to put to take that filter off and say, well, okay, you know, is this game design fair? Is it, you know, kind of it is difficult. So Neil, your experiences with it?
I got to the first boss, so I guess the first two stages or the first level. I don't know exactly how it's broken up.
Yeah.
Each stage has sort of two parts to it, doesn't it?
Okay, so I beat the first stage and beat the bird boss at the end of that one.
Yeah, that's a chicken thing.
By the skin of my teeth, that was a pain in the ass, but it took me way too long. I probably spent, I played it for like an hour or two yesterday, and I could only get through the first part, and then today, before this, I played it for probably about 3 hours and finally got to the end of that stage, and then tried to make headway into the second stage, but that wasn't happening.
Wow.
It does show that how difficult
I'm trying to remember,
is.
Which one was two?
Stage two is the pirate ship.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's a ship one.
It's hot.
That is a tough second
Set
level.
Set sail for adventure, bitches.
That's right. See, that's the thing. Hey, like, James, I don't know, man, but I'm just like, I love this shit. I'm just like, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. See, now, there are a number of things about this game that, you know, I think instantly make it frustrating for people. First and foremost is the way the jumping works.
Yes.
So the jumping is that a jump's a jump, basically.
Yes.
You do not control it in the air. The Mario thing does not apply here. There's not momentum or inertia or any of that. You know, a jump is as long as you know, is a standard length all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Except you've got a double jump.
Yeah.
And that is the only way that you can kind of modify the jump. And it allows you to change directions in the air. It allows you to jump higher. It allows you to jump longer. And this is where the kind of timing element comes in, because you get to a point where, you know, if I time two jump button presses this closely together, I jump this far.
Right.
So you kind of, you know, you get it in your head that, you know, okay, this is how far the gap is. So I know I need to go, you know, tap in this particular way to get it to jump that far. And that is, you know, to have it be that kind of difficult, or that kind of, to actually just jump a certain length, is very, very different from, indeed, most of the games that were released at the time. Because, you know, Super Mario Brothers is, what, 85?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was so influential that even games that were quite different, there was this kind of common language that most games adopted, that you would have a certain amount of control over.
It established a convention that maybe was to the detriment of the industry a little bit, because then people felt constrained by it.
Yeah, well, there was certainly a hell of a lot of games. I mean, even if you get to things like Castlevania 4.
Yes.
You know, like, even that has the ability to sort of control your jumps to an extent. Not to the extent that you can in Mario, as you might, but, you know.
Well, yeah, because essentially Mario is basically you're temporarily in flight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can do play, you know, with Mario, but you've got the inertia stuff as well, which is kind of another thing. But you know, the main thing is you can kind of, you know, Mario, you can jump forward and then kind of basically think better of it and come all the way back if you like, you know.
See, another issue with that jump that's a problem is not only do you have to know how to tap it to make sure you establish enough distance, but there are platforms where it's a small platform, and if you overshoot it, you're in a hole.
You're dead. You're dead. Yeah.
So you have to not only know how to make the maximum distance, you have to know how to say, okay, I need to jump this exactly this far.
Yeah. Well, that's like the part in the first stage where you have the water coming down, which is the part that gave me the most trouble because you have to do the jumps perfectly, or else, you know, you miss it, you're dead.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way around it. The punishment is death.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, it's very simple.
And you know, especially like for me, I play that first level. I could still remember, you know, this is the timing to get that far. Yes.
Well,
I can just
like,
do it.
I understand where you're coming from, where you know you have like that rhythm to the first level, because that's like how I am for probably the entire first world and the first Ninja Gaiden for NES.
Well, see, there's
which is another really hard game.
Incredibly hard.
Well, there's actually a stage at the end of the game where the platforms, if I recall correctly, move, and you have to jump from one to the other. But while they move, there's also this spinning wheel of death that has one opening in it you have to jump through to get to the next platform.
No, there's a lot of... So like I said, that way the jumping works in that, you know, even in 91 when, you know, at this point you've had Castlevania 4, that's got elements of kind of Mario in it, you know, you've got all this stuff. And Gods of Ghosts, it added the double jump. The double jump was an innovation that had not been in the previous games. So it did make things different in that respect, but... You know, it was still restrictive in a way that most, I think, you know, if you just it's difficult for people to accept. It just is, you know, that this is kind of, there's a sense of how games are supposed to work, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I really liked it as opposed to, because the thing is, I felt on the earlier games, just the way the jumping felt, it was very restrictive.
Well, the thing about it is it's so damn simple in those games because literally, you know, you have got one jump and that's it. So obviously you can't really have this stuff like that we talked about with the first level and some of these other levels where you've got jumps of different distances because you've got a jump of one distance. That's it. All you've got. So the platforming was super simple. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's Super Ghouls and Ghosts, by adding the double jump, actually made the platforming, you know, more intricate and, you know, to some extent, obviously, more difficult.
There's a lot of things you can do with that second jump that essentially...
It's a whole other gameplay element.
Exactly. I thought it really opened the game up.
I mean, it does play, actually, it's called Super Ghouls and Ghosts, you know, you might think it's literally just the Super NES version of the same game of Ghouls and Ghosts that was in the arcade and all that, but it's actually very different. It plays a lot slower, for instance. His walking speed is slower.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was just because of it was a conscious decision or whether it was because the way they used the Super NES hardware because it was an early game or what, but it's a lot slower.
I think there's a really valid reason that would be a conscious decision. Remember, the goal of an arcade game is to kill you as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So making your character move quickly is important.
It's kind of like with Yoshi Touch and Go. When that ramps up, he gets faster. That's how they make it more difficult.
Just to make it more difficult, but to move you from one obstacle to the next in the minimum amount of time, so you die quicker.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. These levels are quite drawn out as well. I mean,
yes,
some of them are
long.
Quite long. I mean, for instance, the second level that we talked about, the pirate ship, you know, the first bit on the ship itself is quite quick, but then when you get to that rafts bit that's sort of fixed scrolling, that it goes on for quite a while.
It does.
And if you get to the end of that and then die at the boss, that's demoralizing.
The worst part is if there's like a part in, I think maybe it's the fourth level, where you can die right off the bat, and just hearing the over and over again, and you keep getting maimed. The very start.
Oh, look, that gives me a sick pleasure. That does.
Because every time you hear it, you've either accomplished something wonderful or you're now swearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Because it is. If you get to the next level, you get that music as you sort of move along the map.
Uh-huh.
But if you die, you get it.
You get that music, and it sends you back to your last checkpoint. Which
it's like just that whole thing, like that little tune and that map, it's like that's burned into my brain.
I'm conditioned to hate that.
But the thing is, it took so long to get, I mean, like, I had this game Christmas Day took me all day to beat the first level, you know, and when I say all day, that was probably what it was, you know, probably stopped for turkey and then straight back to Golden Coast, you know, pretty much the whole waking day, you know, whereas like, say for instance, stuff like DKC, Yoshi's Island, I would beat those by Boxing Day, they were done.
Whereas this
is one day for one level, and those other bits on the map at the end were like some mythical land. You're like, God,
exactly. Like you don't know if they actually exist. They may be on the map, but you don't know if they're actually in the game.
You kind of stare longingly, thinking, God, that ice level's probably really cool, but I'm still stuck dying in the lava on the final.
When I played this back in 1993, and you know, I was playing it cooperatively. I was considerably better than my cousin was at this game. So basically it would be like, he would give me the controller and just say, I want to get to there. And he'd point someone on the map. Can we get there today? And I'd look at him and I'd go, we haven't gotten there before. And his response would be, today we're going to get there. Start playing. And we would just hope to God I made it there. And that ice level, all we ever said about it was, I bet that's really hard.
Yeah, that's a safe bet. But I mean, it's interesting the way this game works in terms of its difficulty. There's a certain amount of it that is memorization. There's no doubt about that. The first level, what Neil talked about, there's a number of things that just the first time you're going to die. The tidal wave. You're not necessarily gonna
do just walking across the ground. Oh God.
Yep.
Yeah.
The first time that happened, I was like, what's going on? I thought I was already getting to that shit part of the map that I saw.
Like the final stage where the world just turns around on you or something like that, turns upside, like it turns sideways.
Yeah, if you're not in the little pod or whatever, you die instantly pretty much, don't you?
But see, at this point in the game, you're pretty much expecting the game to try to screw you over at every opportunity.
Yeah, so I mean, so very much when you're playing a level for the first time or a part of a level for the first time, it is like just seeing what happens so that you can
sort of
factor that
in. Take a step and wait for the game to try to screw you over.
So as much as it becomes a case of, you know, going through it a number of times, kind of memorizing things, the layout, you know, what will kill you instantly and what won't, you know, how to, you know, even as we said before, like how to do certain jumps, even you kind of have to learn. But there's a certain random element in terms of the spawning in the enemies that can like really screw you over sometimes, because you know you can get in this rhythm of doing a level, but then every now and again something will just interrupt that rhythm that would throw it off and just kill you.
It's not really truly random. It's more like your timing is off from where you last ran it. So now the enemy spawns.
If there's a slight discrepancy, like I guess if you were exactly the same, it would be exactly the same, but you only have to be a little different that makes the enemy spawning different, and then that will throw everything off.
So here's the hint to people who have just played this game for the first time. The first chest in the game is actually before where you start in the game. You have to walk backwards and do a double jump at the tree and it pops up.
Yeah.
But if you do that and get the chest, what's going to happen is a zombie is going to spawn under your fucking feet.
But see, the thing is, though, it'll do that every single time, though, right?
Yeah, it's just a timing thing.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I love about this game is the fact that it's like, my opinion of it is, yes, it's very tough, but most of the time, actually almost all the time, when you die, it's typically your fault. What I mean by that is that there's nothing cheap. There's no random guy coming out of nowhere. It's not like, I mean, you do get knocked back.
There's a random tsunami coming out of nowhere.
I think you've got those first time events. You've got like the avalanche in the snow level and when it rotates in the sort of belly of the beast level. And there's so many things, or like the when the platforms all rise and fall in the lava. And, you know, you have to have known these things. So in that first sense, but after that, once you kind of know the routines, it's more dependable. There's still an element to it that's, you know, it will kill you a lot. You know, there's no, it doesn't matter how good you are at games in general. Like, there's no conceivable way if you had no prior knowledge of the game to just sail through it because you're so good. Just not the way it's.
This game is like trying to learn a foreign language. You're gonna F it up sometimes. It's just a matter of.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a good analogy. analogy with this whole jumping thing, because, you know, it will, especially, you know, if you're going back to this, having played however many years of 2D games, like, since, and, you know, that were made before and since, you're just, it's not gonna mesh with you very well to start with, because there's just this urge to, you know, this expectation and a kind of urge to be able to control it, you know, in the air, and you just can't do it. You just can't, you know, apart from the double jump, which, you know, is in a limited way, you just can't do it. So you have to be, the thing about it is that it, you have to be disciplined about how you jump.
Exactly.
You know what I mean, you kind of think about it like an NFL receiver kind of giving himself up to go and get the ball over the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You
yes.
know, if you leave the ground and you are vulnerable. That, you know, that, you know, yep. if there's a projectile in the air, you can't suddenly
avoid. It is going to hit you.
Yeah, so you have to have dealt with the enemies to whatever extent you can before you jump, or you do, you know, that, which is just so different from other games, completely different. Mm-hmm. It's debatable how much, like, fun it is for a lot of people, because it's not as free. Because that's the great thing about Mario, what was so wonderful about Super Mario Brothers is the feeling of freedom. You know, you can just play it on the fly. You can run really fast and then jump really far.
And then get maimed because you ran really fast.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. You know, the original Super Mario Brothers is a hard game.
Yeah, it is.
You know, they're not so different, you know, but I think in that more fundamental gameplay way, people find it more frustrating in this case.
Yeah, you kind of have to sit back. You have to sit back more and sort of size things up more in this game. You can't just run through it, you know?
Well, and a lot of the time you will have to size things up by basically, accepting the fact that you're going to have to die mm-hmm. a number of times to see how the level works.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then sort of apply yourself to it. So it is a different kind of game. Even, you know, it was kind of throwback even in 91 to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what makes that acceptable to me, well, I think it still has merit rather than being just like some sort of relic or simple for the time, was the fact that they did introduce this sophistication with the double jump and, you know, things like that, because they took away your ability to aim upwards from the previous game in the series. It meant that with a lot of enemies that were tall, you would have to double jump to hit them. Especially if you didn't have the arrows, especially, which are a diagonal firing weapon. So that meant that just even attacking an enemy, you had to be really careful, because again, once you went up, you were coming down at a fixed rate. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing you can do to kind of change that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole different language for me.
Yeah, maybe I didn't intend that to be as good an analogy as it is, but it really does work on certain levels.
And it sounds I think it does.
It's
like learning
another language so you can take the SATs in it.
Yeah.
That's what it really feels like. You have to learn this language, then take the SATs. So not just learning the rhythm, but you have to go execute.
Yeah, but then you have to apply it in complicated ways, in very sophisticated ways that, you know, that even a lot of other games that you don't have to kind of rewrite the rules for, don't. So we'll get on to some of the forum posts. So we'll start, appropriate enough, I guess, with Voodoo, who was sort of lobbyist in chief for this game being in the retroactive. So it begins with, "I love this game."
The end.
It's my first experience with any game from the series, and I'm honestly blown away. I die often, but I'm rarely frustrated. Every time I die, I know it was my fault. I jumped at the wrong time. I was too eager and tried to rush through the level. That is definitely true.
You will die.
I mean, sometimes there is a need for a certain amount of urgency because of what James talked about with enemies spawning under you or whatever. If you just sort of dilly dally.
Well, and because it is so timing based, if you're falling behind where you normally are,
yeah, then you're kind of off the map, aren't you? You don't know kind of what you're supposed to be doing at that moment. So, I mean, that's definitely true. He also says, regardless, I learn from each death and do my best not to repeat my mistakes. So, yeah, that is the point of the game, learning from your mistakes. I mean,
the thing is, I agree with him 1,000%.
No, that's really how I feel about it from playing it for a little bit. It's hard. And I mean, it's frustrating on one end just because, you know, it's difficult, but it's not frustrating in like, ah, this game's so cheap. It's frustrating because it's like, oh, I made the mistake. I shouldn't have rushed that. I'll have to look out for that next time. It's very good at that. And I'm not necessarily blown away by it, but I'm definitely really impressed.
Mm-hmm. So the next forum post I picked out, this was sort of the other side of the coin. Gojira posted, quite frankly, I've never found this game all that fun, but I do own it, so I decided to give the game another go for Retroactive. I'm just going to say, F this game.
Fantastic.
I'm glad there are people who enjoy this game, but it is really not for me.
Hire this man.
This is the other side of the coin. It does not surprise me at all. And you know, it's fair enough. You know, I mean, if you just are not, you know, this is a particular kind of satisfaction that you get out of this. As much as I enjoy it, and like I said, you know, that probably has a lot to do with it just being embedded in a very early age.
Yes.
You know, this was something that was kind of acceptable to my sensibilities. You know, but I can perfectly understand other people just not getting on with it at all.
You know, it's funny because This game might have some of the same satisfaction that monks felt during, you know, self-flagellation. I've suffered, but I'm better for it. and you know, it's just the reward factor. You know, there was a 60.5-year gap between when I played this game and when I beat it. And that long time, you know, I never really forgot about the game. It didn't haunt my dreams or anything, but I never really forgot about it. I didn't wake up in the middle of the night going, "Arthur, no!" And then go, "Oh God, it's just a dream." But
and then the music cues up again.
Damn it! But when I finally beat it, or actually when I finally hit the end and I got jumped back to the beginning, I looked at the TV. I gave it the most annoyed and angered stare I've ever given anything ever. Like if the TV had feelings, it would have burst into tears at that point, just from the stare. <at me. laughs> Because it was. I have never transmitted hatred to an object through my eyes.
It was a rude awakening because, you know, I remember, you know, playing the game at the time, you know, when it was really fresh, really new. You know, it was technically very impressive.
Yes.
You know, the graphics were
cool.
I mean, when you look back at it now, I don't think it has aged quite as well as something like Castlevania 4.
No.
Some of the backgrounds, like some of the, like the obvious is like parallax, there's multiple layers of the backgrounds, but some of the sort of the furthest most backgrounds are really basic, like almost like two colors.
Yeah.
You know, like black and blue or black and gray, or, you know, really, really basic. And that kind of shows up more now, but, you know, at the time it seemed like
there's
really impressive. So you're playing through the game, you've got, you know, you want to see, you know, you've seen the ice stage on the map, you want to see what that's like, all the different cool stuff in it, you know, that's what you're playing for. Especially for me, you know, 16-bit gaming was a novelty then, you know, so every, you know, that was so much of what went into it for me. But then, you know, you kind of get towards the end and all of a sudden it kind of boils down to these really basic castle levels. You know, they're like single background, they've got like a lot of the same enemies, you know, from previous, but just more of them and like more evil. And you've got
more
like
evil.
The bosses repeat. You fight a variation of the same boss like three times in two levels.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it got really like, you know, this is kind of going downhill a bit. But it's like, oh, but, you know, the last boss is coming or whatever. And then it's like, no, it's not unless you play through the entire game again.
Well, he's coming, but do you have two more hours to devote to that cause?
Yeah.
See, the thing that always got me about that was the only thing you really gained is the bracelet weapon, which itself is an instrument of pure destruction.
But I mean, the thing about the bracelet weapon that's interesting is like its earliest form, as in when you don't have, so in this game the way it works is you have you power up through getting better armor.
Yes.
And that is quite an infrequent occurrence.
Yeah.
These are not, it's not anywhere near as common as like when you power up the whip in Castlevania, or, you know, like you'd get stuff in a shooter game.
And it's very easy to lose that armor.
The chests are like you said, like sometimes the chests are like really weird. Like if you crouch in this place, a chest appears.
Yes.
Or like if you double jump in this place, a chest appears. But for the kicker, a lot of the time they're filled with a guy that comes out and turns you into a baby.
Yeah,
or a bee.
Yeah, like,
I was actually reading on a fan site. They refer to it as the Arthur.
Nice.
R.I.P.
It's far too frequent for me. It really is, because at some point it's just like you will see a chest there, and you're like, do I even want to bother opening it?
If you have gold armor, you just don't open the chests.
No, yeah. Once you get to that point, there is no incentive.
Because you know, you do realize once you have gold armor, they all have that motherfucker in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you find that out like pretty quickly. You're like, oh shit.
But that's the point. With the gold armor, your weapons are sort of fully powered up and you have like a special ability you can do and stuff. But with the bracelet, it kind of starts off pretty crappy. It's like the lance, but with poorer range.
Yes.
You know, and like it's not very powerful. And then once you get up to the gold armor, it's actually pretty useful. But as you say, the propensity for you to lose that armor very quickly is so great that most of the time you're going to be using the bracelet weapon that's like the, in its crappy form. Which, you know, again, makes the game, like, even less sort of palatable to be going through again.
And you're terrified to give it up because you don't realize that these motherfuckers are going to drop it every
time. Exactly. Like, for me, when I first did it, it's like, okay, so this is it now? Like, if I pick up the arrows, is that game over? You know, like, I did, you know, especially when you're a kid.
Guess what? Going back!
Well, I mean, so we'll move on to some more forum posts. So Voodoo posted again, and this time he actually had some not entirely glowing things to say about the game. Two complaints about Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Just two. The first is that the bosses are pretty forgettable. After playing some great treasure games lately, these guys just don't stand up. They're not flashy. They're not especially difficult. They're just there.
I agree.
I agree entirely. And I mean, even at the time, they didn't seem, you know, even with the graphical novelty and stuff, they just did not seem particularly special. And now, I mean, they're just so damn simple
as
well. I mean, they are really not anything special at all. And like I said, it even gets worse at the end where it kind of degenerates into the repetition of a boss that I think would have been in Ghosts and Goblins. Basically, it was like fan service that, you know, I remember this guy from Ghosts and Goblins, fight him three times. sort of thing.
Hey, you again.
That's kind of this game in a nutshell, though. I mean, there's a lot of, like, it's almost like you think there's going to be something big and amazing at the end, but it's like kind of like, oh, that was all? That was it?
No, you know? I guess, like, if you were some sort of, like, hardcore Ghosts and Goblins fanboy, maybe it kind of was some sort of big joy. I kind of doubt it, though. And so his second complaint is that from level 4 until the end of the game, you need to use the arrows. It's not just that the arrows are the best weapon to use. The other weapons will actually hurt your chances of progressing. Mm-hmm. There are a few times when I accidentally picked up another weapon and I wasted several lives just to get the arrows back.
Like the torch?
Oh, yeah.
That will fuck you every time?
The fucking torch.
I see what you mean. So there are definitely parts of the game where the point is the arrows fire diagonally upwards.
Uh-huh.
So yes. The big thing about that is you don't necessarily have to jump up to hit higher targets. And as we said, jumping up makes you really quite vulnerable in this game. So if you can avoid that, that is a big help. So the arrows are kind of fundamentally better than all the other weapons.
But then the arrows can't really hit anything on like in front of you.
Well, you can crouch, though. Like, if you crouch, then that kind of solves that problem a little bit.
I use the daggers a lot more, though, in part because of the super R-type sound effects we've got going on when you throw
ding,
them.
Ding, 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 ding,
ding. Jing, jing, jing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the daggers are cool because of the rapid rate of fire.
Yeah.
So you can kind of, like, because sometimes they're so slow, if you kind of jump, like the other weapons, if you jump up but then miss time when you throw it, you might not even end up hitting what you wanted to hit. Whereas with the daggers, because they're more rapid, it's like, well, you'll get it right, one of them. You know,
you just keep
you
pounding
sort of
that button.
Yeah, just do a little spread and it'll
really
kind of work.
It really does look like, when that thing fires off, if you removed all the other layers and just the weapon layer, you would think it was an R-type game. Because it even got like little metal.
Well,
like little
the whole layout. Game kind of just struck me as like shooter-like in a sense, just because of the way, you know, you build up your weapons, albeit I know Greg, you made the point before the show about how it's a lot slower and more
infrequent. It's more infrequent and
but
more easily
it's just the way
lost.
That you build it up, and like, if you die, you're fucked. Everything's gone.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. And of course, like we said, it doesn't really sort of play as freely as a platformer does either. So it is like almost like a hybrid kind of game, but played at a slower pace. Definitely than most shooters. And so, I mean, this issue with the weapons, I think, is a good point because, as we said, you may become to depend on the arrows. In some of these levels because they're so much better, but then of course you'll have to spend maybe significant portions of it when you play through it again without them, so you're gonna have to get used to it sooner or later, unfortunately. So we're gonna kind of move towards the end of the discussion with just the final boss itself. I have seen it, I have played it, and it isn't that great.
No.
actually, as sort of Adad, is it Adadad, I think it is, sort of, it's as ridiculously defensive as this must sound, I didn't find repeating the game to be too bad.
Wrong.
It was a huge shock, of course, but when I started it again, it was satisfyingly easy. Okay, easier. See, still I wrong. Don't know about that. Yeah. Especially if you're trying to use the bracelet.
Or especially if you're enraged.
Yeah, you're fighting back the tears. It's very difficult. Anyway, it definitely ensures that the player has mastered the double jump and then some. I mean, if you close that by saying, bit like what you guys said on RFN about Super Metroid not making the most of its final sequence, I'd argue that the final boss here is too easy and simple after such a hard, artificially doubled endeavour.
I mean,
there's no way it could possibly live up to what it takes to get there, but it is kind of poor.
I don't think it needs to. I think at that point the game should just reward you for getting there. You know what I mean? Like, imagine if you ran out of continues on the final boss after having to beat the game twice. Would that SNES not wind up through your TV set? Is there any chance that doesn't happen? No.
Yeah. No.
I'm kind of glad I never did it, actually, because it might have happened.
There's no chance that it might have happened. It would have happened. TVs across the country would have been destroyed.
I mean, mm-hmm. I guess the thing is, like, at least he is big, like the final boss, Sardius. He is, like, over a screen tall, like, pretty much, like, two screens tall. So in those days, that was so much of, you know, whether a game was good or not, obviously, was how big the sprites were. So, China Warrior says hi.
China Warrior.
You can't do that for every game.
It's
only the best. It's only the best.
You are ruining it. Now we're the seal of approval.
Sorry.
But, you know, I mean, it can't live up to that. But, I mean, it's much like the rest of the bosses in the game. It just wasn't that great.
No.
I mean,
it was what it was, you know? I mean, it was just a thing there to conclude the game.
I think you would have been better off just having that as the last boss the first time round. You know, it was sort of pretty satisfyingly long, I think, for the time, you know, and obviously it took a while to get through it because of how difficult it was. So I just, you know, I assume that was a creation of the arcade games, that you would go through the second time round, you know, again, just to get people to put more quarters in or whatever. So what it's doing in this game, I have no idea, because this is exclusive to the console.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no justification for it other than this sort of slavish adherence to sort of franchise protocol, if you like.
Yeah, it's just flat out malicious, really.
It's just
it comes down to it.
It is a bad decision. Just, you know, I mean, they could at least have if they wanted to make you play through the game with the bracelet, for instance, they could have at least just given you a password that mm-hmm. would let you then sort of jump to level one with the bracelet. You've got to have that. You know, that's the Super NES back in the day. You're on continuously.
Yes, as it overheated and slowly began to melt.
So, yeah, it's just a bad decision. But, I don't, you know, it doesn't take away, for me, ultimately, as much as that kind of enraged me when I was little, and I still find it distasteful now. You know, you still can't deny the fun I had with it earlier. You know, there's so many things that I do like about that game. I think the music's great. I mean, it's not as orchestral as like Castlevania 4, but it's kind of a bit more whimsical and catchy. And there's some really nice bits, like the ice level is really sort of cinematic and stuff. So it's certainly a huge quantum leap over what was in the previous games of the series. So there's a lot to like about it. I could see the why that a lot of people have expressed why they don't like the kind of restrictive gameplay, but I don't think that the fact they don't like it makes it inherently bad. You know, I kind of like the way that, you know, not every game has to play in this sort of the same way. You know, it's nice to have something that does challenge you in a different way.
Well,
and I don't think it's just mercilessly cheap.
I mean, that's the thing. I don't think it's cheap, first off, and also the way that it's structured such that it's kind of, you know, you inch along, trial and error, and you kind of figure out, you know, the way to play through everything. It kind of reminds me of, on the N64, it reminds me of GoldenEye. GoldenEye, to me, was very much that way, where...
Yeah, you put that on 00 Agent.
Yeah.
You know.
I just wanted to kick in my TV sometimes, but you would just inch ahead, and you would find out the exact angles to, you know, go against a wall and, you know, pick off some guys and just... I mean, it reminds me of that quite a bit.
I think that's a really good comparison because, you know, and I mean, God, some of those missions could go on a bit, couldn't they? You wanted to pull your hair out after something went wrong at the end of them, like Natalia got blown up or whatever.
So many times that happened.
Yeah, the only one thing I think we haven't mentioned, that does bother me is the way that because you can get the green and the gold armor, and it doesn't really do anything for you aside from upgrading whatever you happen to be.
Weapon.
Think about it this way: you're not going to have two other armors under your gold armor.
But my point is, it's like if you're going to do that, why not make the green armor allow you to get take two hits? And the gold armor, since you earn them, you work your ass off to get that armor.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think the infrequency with which you get it would kind of suggest that wouldn't have been an unreasonable thing to have in the game, or certainly at a certain difficulty level you could have had that in the game. I think that's definitely justified, because as you have to work hard to get these things, and then they're gone in a blink of an eye. Whereas, say, for instance, if you just went down from gold to green, and therefore it wouldn't be that hard to necessarily go back to gold again, that would be kind of make those, because those parts of the game, having the special abilities that you have with the gold armor, or the shield that you have with the gold armor, I can hardly remember using them because I just never did.
I used the hell out of them.
I kind of learned to beat the levels with the silver armor, the standard armor, because sometimes I'd get on a roll with the gold armor and kind of you go, but a lot of the time it's one mistake and it's gone, and then you're gonna have to do it with the silver armor. So that's generally kind of how I didn't really concern myself with getting it at one point, because I'm like, oh, I'll just lose it anyway.
I used it a lot because I really just enjoyed using the special power. So I'd
that's what's sad, because I didn't really exploit that part of it probably.
I don't remember which one gives you the dragons that basically fly around the screen and wipe everything out. But I would get that, and I would just walk to a screen full of enemies from one edge, charge it up, and let it go before they even knew I was there.
Yeah, so they are cool, and those things that you could do. And I agree with John. I think that's one kind of thing they could have done to improve it, but just make it a bit more kind of friendly, a bit more rational in some ways. But it's an uncompromising game. That's what, to some extent, it does kind of add to its charm. It certainly adds to its sort of infamy. Well, we'll leave it there for this week. I don't know whether we might do a brief wrap up segment next week when Johnny hopefully will return.
Oh, I think we have to just to hear him get angry at it.
Perhaps he can just give us a very terse response.
He can read the post that we didn't say.
Johnny actually posted multiple times in the thread. So if you want to go check it out on the forums, nintendoworldreport.com/forums, in the podcast discussion, Johnny's got quite a few things to say in there that about his distaste for the game, and you can still contribute yourself to the discussion, or maybe if there's a certain amount of new stuff in there, we might return to it next week. Obviously, as well, we also need your emails, more listener mail. Send that into rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And you can also give us feedback by rating us on iTunes. That's always something we like to see more reviews get added up on there. And with that, I'm going to close it out. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Don't forget to check out his Tiger Woods impressions on the site.
Yeah, and the other previews and impressions that had to do with the EA event.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff there. Coverage.
And also, there's just been a lot of events, period. There was a Namco event recently, Konami.
Plenty of stuff to check out over at the site, lots of coverage. And John and James, of course, looking forward to be with you next week.
Mm-hmm, you betcha, man.
Oh, yeah.
See you, everybody.
Later. Yeah.
Bye.
Like, could they do anything else to make that game not sell? God. Aside from that god-awful controller that nobody wanted to buy.
There's about a $300 price of entry. Your memory card blows up whenever you die.
No, what would have been better is if it just starts deleting other games' saves when you die.
Yeah.
Halo, gone.
Sort of like Metal Gear Solid. It's like, oh, I see you play Castlevania. You don't anymore.